Hello, hello, and welcome out there in podcast land. You have reached a little ditty we like to call Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast where two friends get together. We discuss movies, television, literature, all kinds of different things, but always focused on the horror and science fiction genres. We discuss key influences on those films or topics and things that they in turn have influenced. If you're joining us for the first time, hey, great. Thanks. Glad to have you with us. Glad you found us. Hope you like us and come back and tell all your friends. If you are returning, then we must be doing something right, and that's a good thing. So we're glad you're here. My name's David, as I said, and I'm with my good friend Tim. Tim, how are you? You're underwater today on the YouTube.
I am. Yeah. I am. I'm somewhat amphibious this week. I'm doing well.
How's your genre week been going? What have you been doing?
My genre week has been how do I describe my genre week? Let's say in the past, in the way past, a few weeks back, actually, I mentioned that I was reading for the first time Tom Tryon's novel Harvest Home.
Mm-hmm.
And I finished it. It's great. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's good. There's a reason why it was a bestseller. It followed his first novel, The Other. I even found an old Stephen King review of Harvest Home, and he said something to the effect that it's not a great novel, but 40 years from now, it'll be one of those that's still being bound and put on library shelves, which I thought was an interesting way to describe it, considering that it is 40 years later. But anyway, I decided I wanted to see the old television miniseries that Betty Davis was in 1978 or 9, and I couldn't find it until I looked on YouTube, and there it was, a bad VHS transfer of the entire five-hour miniseries.
Wow.
So not only did I read the pretty good book, which this book would fall into that classification that we talked about in past episodes, like folk horror, kind of like The Wicker Man, or even Hereditary to an extent.
Yeah.
This miniseries is terrible. It is directed by Leo Penn, Sean Penn's father. And even with Betty Davis and a somewhat familiar television cast, it is still just awful. And it doesn't capture any of the end of this novel, which is very sexual and very graphic and bloody and sacrificial. And you couldn't do that on NBC. I think it was NBC back in the late 70s.
Right.
Not even with Betty Davis as clout. So she did campaign for the role, I read, which I thought was funny.
Interesting.
She plays the widow. I can't remember her last name, but she's the widow, what's her name, in the movie. Anyway, do you remember anything about either of these? Have you read or seen
a little bit? I've never read the novel, but I do remember watching the miniseries. But again, it was kind of like I felt like I did when I watched, you know, like we covered Salem's Lot. It was like, you know, this is just really bad. There was another one too. What was the other one where the house at the end freaks out and like gets new paneling and everything else?
That sounds like Burnt Offerings. But
yeah, Burnt Offerings.
Release.
Yeah. Burnt Offerings.
I mean, that's a little bit better.
Yes, yeah, a little bit better.
It is. Yeah. You know why you think it, you know why you associate it with TV? Because it was Dan Curtis that directed it.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Even though it was theatrical, he was, you know, Mr. Dark Shadows and things. So,
yeah.
But yeah. Good stuff. So in the old closet with like cobwebs and crap.
In the old closet. Yeah. My
so
genre, the only thing I did was a new closet. So I found, you know, I've been trying to find podcasts that I genuinely like that are compelling or interesting to me or whatever. And also, you know, so that we may learn something from it, but also that, you know, it's entertaining. And I stumbled across one called The Cinephiles. I actually found it because I was looking to see if anybody was similar to our other Patreon podcast, the Dilithium Chamber, where we do Star Trek. Well, there's two guys, and they do one called the Enterprise Incidents. I-N-C-I-D-E-N-T-S.
That's great. It's a play on the title.
Right. And they cover Classic Trek. They're both huge Classic Trek fans and like it. Well, they have a side podcast they do called The Cinephiles. C-I-N-E-F-I-L-E-S. And I've listened now to like four episodes of theirs, and it's awesome. They're mostly because they just remind me of us. They're really good. They're very intelligent. One of them is an actor and a directing teacher. He teaches at a college in L.A. The other one is a voiceover actor who's also a host for a lot of events and live entertainment and stuff like that. And so they're both very I think they're similar in age to us. They have similar tastes, except their podcast covers all different movies. Like I listened, of course, naturally to the one on The Godfather, because I thought it was great. But I just finished this morning listening to Silence of the Lambs. And it reminded me of when we did it and everything else. And they actually had two or three little things that we didn't cover. And I was going, really? I never knew that kind of thing. So, but I highly recommend it. If you guys like podcasts, look up the Cinephiles. And they've got like 200-plus episodes. And it's all good movies. It's all good stuff that they cover. So, again, they're not tied to the genres like we are, but they're really good.
Yeah, that reminds me of something I watched last night. Netflix has this show called The Movies That Made Us. It's got three seasons.
Yeah.
And the latest season is horror and sci-fi. And I am not a fan of the format. It's a little fast and a little jokey and a little annoying.
I agree.
But once they got into it and started talking with people, like I was watching the one on Halloween, they were talking to like Erwin Yablans and Nick Castle and even Dean Cundey a little bit. Not Carpenter or Curtis, mind you, but the other people involved with the movie. And I learned some things that we didn't talk about either that were really kind of fun and surprising. One was an incident where Donald Loomis got drunk. I mean, not Donald Loomis, Donald Pleasance got drunk. So bottled wine comes up a few times in that episode.
Interesting. I think I've watched the first two seasons because they did Back to the Future, I think. They did Dirty Dancing. Something else, and I watched it, and it's, I agree with you. I think the format's kind of like, it reminds me of like an early 80s documentary, you know?
It's like pop culture-y.
Yeah,
Like MTV or VH1, you know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. Like, it's like an old VH1.
Graphic, yeah.
Yeah, and their approach is a little bit, especially with that heavy-handed narration that they do, is a little bit jokey and doesn't really, I think, pay homage, right homage to the films. But
But, I mean, this new season is, and by the time this airs, it won't be new, but this recent season is, it's all horror and sci-fi, and it reads just like our podcast. I mean, it's like, you know, Aliens, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Halloween, everything that we've already done.
all the classics. You know, or whatever.
Yeah. So I guess I will end up watching some more.
You'll have to.
Anyway, I didn't mean to segue, but it just kind of tied in with your genre wheat piece.
No, because, you know, monster movies are the topic of the day today. So that works
for
me.
They are. And it's kind of a science fiction topic as well as a horror topic.
Yep.
But this one falls over onto me this week. We are underwater, if you haven't guessed by my graphics. And we are journeying back several decades to 1954's Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yes. Look at that.
Wow.
Right there.
I love First of all, I have been waiting to do this one because I have been jonesing to get back into Universal Horror territory for a while. And I had so much fun with this and watching it that I... And granted, viewers or listeners out there don't know this, but there are a few more Universals coming up this season.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm already planning on another one next season because I just love going back to these movies.
Yes.
Before I go into a synopsis, do you want to talk about any of your memories of this movie?
I love this movie. I love this movie. I do have some caveats, you know, takeaways once we get into it. But I remember, again, like so many of my influences of older films, you know, naturally I wasn't alive in 54, but... I remember seeing this on Shock Theater. I remember seeing it several times on Shock Theater. And every time I had to watch it. You know, every time. It's one of those where, Creature from the Black Lagoon is on. And had such memories of it because I loved the creature design. I liked the story format. I liked the way they did it. Loved the black and white. I mean, one of the biggest notes I've got in my rewatch notes this time is that final shot always gets me. It always both made me feel sad and frightened at the same time. That whole, just his body prone with the one arm up and the one arm down, and he's just slowly sinking down, you know, into the black and everything. Just so great, such a great ending. Because I mean, there's nothing else. It's just, and we're done. Credits.
Right.
But I remember... loving it when I first saw it. It scared me, but it also just really interested me. I love the science angle of it, of course. The fact that they're saying this is evolution, this is, you know, all of that. I like the fact that it had, that you could get models of it and glow-in-the-dark models of it.
I had one. Yeah,
yes, Aurora model. I did too.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, yeah. What about you?
Well, I was going to say the first, I don't have a distinct memory, but I'm for certain that it was on like Shock Theater or something. Mm-hmm. I saw it as a kid. And it's one of those, I was like you, I wouldn't miss it. I think a lot of what drew me to it was not only the science of it, but the setting as well, because it was kind of an exotic setting for a Universal horror movie. It was not in Transylvania or some European mountains. It was in the Amazon. They never say that, but it is, I'm assuming, the Amazon River.
No, they say the Amazon several times.
Do they?
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, because every time I went to check, I couldn't find it anywhere in my research. And I was like, why doesn't this say what river that is? It's a big river because there's like a lot of room down there and there's caves and stuff, which is kind of funny. Yeah, it kind of looked like the ocean at times.
Yeah, we kind of got into like a Pacific Northwest kind of feel there. At the
Actually, it was Florida, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they filmed in Florida, yes.
Yeah.
But it had that kind of feel there with the caves. And also the interior set caves, which looked like sets but still look cool. You know, it's that Star Trek feel.
Yeah.
You know.
For sure. Okay, brief synopsis. We have, and I'm going to hopefully not mess up these names. Let me pull them up in front of me. We have a Dr. Carl Maya who discovers an artifact. It's like a fossilized hand kind of sticking out of a rock.
Mm-hmm.
It's a skeletal webbed hand that he believes could be a link to evolution as far as us coming from the ocean, our relation to amphibic creatures. And he decides that further research is warranted. He leaves his trusted assistants, goes and tries to recruit some friends and colleagues to help him with an investigation, including a former student named Dr. David Reed, his girlfriend, Kay, another colleague, Dr. Mark Williams, as well as an older colleague, Dr. Edwin Thompson. Meanwhile, while he's off doing this little convincing of them to come down, his colleagues that he left behind are murdered. by this creature, which we only see in the beginning as just a hand coming out of the water. They do a really good job of like not showing the monster right away, so that you kind of are creeped out by it. They go down, do some investigating, this group of professors that I mentioned, and they decide they can't find anything. So they decide they're going to have to go further down the river because maybe the embankment collapsed and washed further down the river. This is what I was talking about as far as logic. And the creature is curious and follows them to what is known as the Black Lagoon. I find this funny because the movie's called Creature from the Black Lagoon, but he's obviously not from the Black Lagoon if he went there to follow them. Anyway, the creature becomes obsessed with Kay when she is swimming. So we've got the whole Beauty and the Beast theme getting woven into this, even though it is a science fiction kind of horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, things happen. At one point, the creature is captured. And being not so guarded, not so well by Dr. Edwin, who is falling asleep, he escapes. Kay, he tries to kill Edwin, as a matter of fact, and Kay stops him by shattering a lantern on him and setting him on fire. He dives back into the water. There's a lot of fighting between Dr. Mark and Dr. David. David wants to learn from the creature and keep it alive, whereas Mark kind of wants to kill it because he's more of a hunter than a scientist, I would say, or he acts like one anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they realize things are getting kind of crazy, decide they need to leave. The creature blocks the river. This is another one of those strange plot devices with a bunch of locks.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark is off hunting it by himself. He gets killed. Kay gets captured, taken to the creature's underwater cave, where Dr. David has to go down and rescue her. And they do end up having to potentially kill the creature, which is what leads to that last shot that you mentioned of mm-hmm. him dying mm-hmm. at the end.
Yeah, and I think that was, I like the ambiguity that they left without it being so in your face, oh, this could be a sequel. Because, I mean, we do see him like harpooned like three freaking times and he's still moving around.
He's got like an arrow sticking out of his back at one point.
Yeah, yeah, so, but he seems to come back from that. So he could probably come back from three or four gunshot wounds to the chest, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which he does, unfortunately. They do make a part two and a part three, I think, don't they? Isn't this a trilogy?
Yes, there are. And I tried to start the second one. I have all three on DVD, and I couldn't get into it.
Yeah, I think the third one really isn't as bad as the second one. The second one's really bad. The third one's okay. Creature Walks Among Us, I think, is the third one.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And it's they play it more on the sympathy card. It's more the... even more King Kong than this is, even though the huge key to this is King Kong. But Creature Walk Among Us is, I just seem to remember images of, because they try to human him. They try to put human DNA in him and change his look.
Something happens to him, and in order to save them, he has to be able to breathe or something. I read this.
Well, it's because they burned him or something or whatever.
Yeah, and so he does look more human.
But there's so many shots of him just, you know, standing behind this caged wall, just looking at the ocean and just, you know, breathing and being lonely and alone and isolated. And there's a lot of that sentimentality mm-hmm. to it. I do think it's unique that this one has a creature that you're scared of, but also somewhat sympathetic of. I mean, a lot of that is David's voice, you know, saying, you know, we invaded his territory and all that kind of stuff. But you do feel sympathy for the creature.
Mm-hmm.
There's some cool background to the production of this.
I was hoping we would go there because I've got some stuff too.
I mean, the two biggest ones that I have are this creative team. This is the same creative team that did It Came From Outer Space. So same director, Jack Arnold, who's really good, same writers, same producer, essentially, with Willem Alland, and them all getting back together to do a totally different feel. I mean, if you watch both of those movies back to back, you would not think it was the same team. But they're both really classic.
I don't know that I've ever seen It Came From Outer Space.
Add it to the list. We got to have
I think it may be on there already. We just haven't chosen it.
But yeah, it becomes a, you know, it is a, it's a, both of them are classic science fiction films. It does not have a creature feature like the Universal does, but it's good.
Well, what I have seen that Jack Arnold also did is The Incredible Shrinking Man, which is also on the list. And I love that movie.
Yes. Another great one.
As well as Tarantula, which I watched last year, and This Island Earth, which we covered last season. He did not get credited for that. That was credited to Robert, was it Newton? Is that his name?
Yep.
Robert something. And but he, Jack Arnold was brought in to salvage some stuff, including the scenes on Metaluna, which so Arnold did that as well as a shit ton of television, pretty much every episode of the Brady Bunch and Gilligan's Island. I mean, a lot of television.
Right.
So Jack Arnold is a well-known Hollywood director, both television and film. You mentioned the other guy, William Allen, and the other writers were Harry Essex and Arthur Ross. And actually Maurice Zim. But did you know that there was a connection to this movie and Orson Welles? That's what fascinated
me. Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Tell the story. Yes, there is. Huge. More than one, actually.
William Allen. Huh?
More than one, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, you may know more than me then. The one I'm talking about is that William Allen was also an actor in Citizen Kane, as well as, get this, producer of The Deadly Mantis, which we also covered last year.
Yes.
Cracks me up. Anyway, apparently William Allen had, he was a member of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater, and he heard some famous Mexican cinematographer named Gabriel Figueroa tell of a legendary humanoid creature that supposedly lived in South America. And that's where the genesis of this whole idea came from.
Yep.
And that's why he's credited as being a writer. It was more his idea. I don't think he actually wrote it. But fascinating stuff.
Yes. And which kind of is a good segue into my, my big cool thing that I love about this history, so to speak, because it was Alan's idea. He's the one that really approached Universal. He's the one that really came up with it, spent time, you know, giving suggestions. Even though he wasn't a writer, he would got a lot of suggestions and stuff like that. But the other thing that was very interesting was the creature design, which I've always loved, thought is just an incredible design, was there was a big controversy over it because it's credited with Bud Westmore, who was the big makeup artist at Universal. However, it was originally created and built and sculpted by Millicent Patrick. Do you know who she is?
I watched a documentary on the making of this film that I had on DVD, and David Scow, who is a horror writer I like a lot, was adamantly, or should I say vehemently, defending her because he said they basically bamboozled her out of credit for this because she was a woman.
Oh, yeah.
But it was totally her baby.
Totally sexist. They took it away from her, and Westmore took credit for it and everything else. But the interesting thing, some interesting things about her, and this is kind of the connection thing, Millicent actually grew up in William Randolph Hearst's estate. At Hearst Castle.
Okay.
Because her father was the chief engineer on it. So they lived on the property. So that's where she grew up, is the inspiration for Citizen Kane. She then later became a Disney animator and was in charge of a bunch of, I mean, had worked on Fantasia, especially Night on Bald Mountain and everything else. She did a bunch of stuff with Disney. before she essentially, you know, went over to Universal and started designing and all of that. And her husband was the original Lone Ranger. She married the Lone Ranger.
Oh, I know his name. Crab?
Yep.
Is it Buster?
Yep.
Is that his name?
Yep.
Something Crab?
Buster Crab.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay.
So she had a very unique career, so to speak, to say the least.
Well, in this documentary, they would show pictures of her painting and drawing this creature.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was right there. She was doing it. You saw her doing it. It was like, that's her.
Well,
that's not this other guy.
And the thing that works, too, to me is you don't see it in the credits, but there's a guy named Jack Keevan I looked up and found in research. He actually built the suits that they used.
Okay.
And they are brilliantly constructed. You don't see any zippers. You don't see any attachments. They're designed, you know, one's designed to be in the water. One is designed to be out. But they glisten. They look like an amphibian. I mean, it's really a great design. And he's not credited either. Westmore took all of that credit. And
lovely.
That's unfortunate because I really do like Bob Westmore.
What is he known for besides this?
What now?
What is Westmore? Oh, you know what? He took Jack Pierce's place in Universal history.
Correct.
He was like Jack was his predecessor. Okay, I got it now.
And I did have, let me see if I can find it in my notes, I did have a list of some of his because, you know, he's gone on to do a bunch. Close Encounters. He did the designs for Close Encounters. He did a bunch of Spielberg.
Wow.
I mean, he's just done a lot. He did Twilight Zone.
It makes you question how much he did.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
You know,
there would be that. Wonder if he did or not.
It also makes me, and this is another thing I was going to say, is that this is the last Universal monster. Out of all the big ones, you know, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, the Mummy, Dracula, the Creature from the Black Lagoon was really the last Universal monster. Some people lump King Kong and Godzilla in there, but they're not really Universal monsters. King Kong maybe, but Godzilla certainly isn't.
Well, and I'm going to say it's the best in my...
This one?
Oh, yeah.
It's not my favorite, but I do like it. Anyway... What I was getting at is I wonder if the fact that Westmoreland did that, if that had anything to do with this being the final Universal monster.
Ooh, no, I don't think so. No, because that sexism still continued on past 54, as far as that goes. I mean,
yeah, but maybe he didn't have the inspiration himself to create a new Universal monster.
Well, maybe. Yeah, it could have been that, just lack of creativity.
Yeah. Or it could have just been genre fads or whatever, going out of style.
Yeah, I think it's more so that, you know, the monsters went away and suddenly everything in the late 50s became more the sci-fi and that sort of feel than it
was.
That
makes more sense.
Creatures anymore. But yeah, I mean, I like Bela Lugosi's Dracula. I like... I like Frankenstein. I like the Wolfman. They're all three great, but the creature will always be my favorite.
I would be really hard to choose. It would be hard for me to choose between Frankenstein and the Wolfman. Dracula is not a great film. It's good for what it is, but it's not. It doesn't have the emotion that these other three have. That Frankenstein, Wolfman, Creature have.
Correct. Correct. Well, I think they learned as they went. I mean, we covered Dracula already. We did Wolfman already. We have not done...
No, we haven't covered Dracula.
We did Nosferatu. We didn't do Dracula.
We did Nosferatu, yeah.
And we've done Wolfman.
We've done Wolfman and Frankenstein.
Yeah.
But there's still... You've still got Dracula, the Invisible Man, and the Mummy.
The Mummy... Mm-hmm. Yeah, we may have to double feature the Mummy and do one of those like Christopher Lee.
You are on my train of thought.
Christopher Lee
I
Hammer
was already
mummies.
Thinking about next season.
Because one of the Hammer mummies I seem to remember is really good.
Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
then you've also got that crap that Brendan Fraser did.
You hinted on one of the elements that I really do like about this movie that I think does keep it endearing is that it is a... There is more emotional context to it. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I think David is verbalizing a lot of that with you know, no, don't shoot him anymore. Let him go, you know, kind of thing. And there's that whole sequence you got shown there is one of my favorite sequences from the movie, which is where she's swimming and he's right mm-hmm. underneath her. And there's
right.
the one time when she stops and she's treading water and he's like reaching, you know, up about to grab her ankle and stuff. And it's both scary and erotic and weird. And it's really good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's Beauty and the Beast, big time.
Oh, yeah, there's your key.
yeah. we can't even begin to talk about scenes like that without talking about Rico Browning, who played the creature underwater.
Yes.
And was not an actor, really, but a diver, swimmer?
He was.
He was an athlete, an aquatic athlete. Let's yep. put it that way. And he did do all of the underwater ballet, so to speak, in Florida. It was filmed in Florida.
Yes. He also had a huge input into filming those scenes.
The documentary I saw was made when a lot of these folks were still alive, including Rico and the woman that plays Kay, Julie Adams. And they talked to them. And she was like, yeah, it's really weird. You know, you can watch this movie. And she's like, that's in California. Wait, that's in Florida. That's in California. And they're just back and forth. And she said, but it's edited together seamlessly. And it really is.
It is.
It doesn't look that way.
It is.
At all.
Well, because, I mean, and I think we should say it since we're in production. So almost all of the underwater photography took place at a place called Wiki Wachi, which was a mermaid show area in Florida. But all of the above water stuff was actually shot on Gilligan's Island.
I was going to say, there are some scenes that I was like, that has to be where they shot Gilligan's Island. It looks exactly the same.
Yes, it's Universal Lagoon where they shot Gilligan's Island. Yes, that's where they filmed all that.
And coincidentally, Jack Arnold directed Gilligan's Island.
There you go.
So he knew it was there.
But it seamlessly edits together. It's really good. And I think a lot of that has to do with just pre-planning, working it through, how they did the storyboards and how they decided to do it. But also, I think Browning had a huge influence. He went on to direct all of the underwater stuff from Thunderball. So all of that underwater battles and the harpooning and all that stuff, you can see it here too. You can see how good he is at doing the underwater stuff. You know, even though I think some of the pacing is a little long in places here, there's sometimes where we linger a little bit too much underwater, but it works for me because it's the creature. I don't care.
Well, and they weren't used to seeing that back in the 50s.
Right.
So it was fascinating to them getting to see all this underwater photography.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, I have a note that we didn't touch on. William Allen, before uh-huh. he did Citizen Kane, the reason that he was in Citizen Kane as an actor, he was actually a member of the Mercury Theater. So he was also one of the voices for War of the Worlds.
Oh, okay. Yep. Well, there you go. Yeah, I knew that he was in the theater troupe. And that's how he got cast in Citizen Kane. I mean, that's the big connection right there, Orson Welles.
Yep.
But I have another small note that kind of fascinates me because I never really knew it to be.
Mm-hmm.
But there are three people credited for the score of this film, and one of them is Henry Mancini.
I didn't know that until I did this research. You're correct. Yes.
I did not realize he was a studio musician for Universal before he became so famous. I mean, we're talking the guy that did Moon River in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the guy that did the Pink Panther music. I mean, this guy is really a huge composer.
Mm-hmm.
And he is credited to I think it's like a third. I don't know. They each contributed a substantial amount.
Well, and
between the three of them.
And watching it again, I was struck with actually how much music is in this movie. I mean, we remember mm-hmm. the theme, of course, but there's entire sequences where there's always music or sound effects, or you hear in the, you know, the jungle or whatever, but there's mm-hmm. sound
the
mixing
Gilligan's Island
all
sound
way
bites.
Through this. Yeah.
but that you mentioned already the reason for that, and it's because of all the underwater footage. I think I read somewhere that there's like 51, I may have that number wrong, 51 minutes of music in this movie.
That makes sense.
And it's be- it's because there's so much underwater footage, they had to have something while that was going on because there's no dialogue.
Yeah, you can't just listen to aqua lungs the whole time. I thought that was funny. Scuba, as a term, had not even been invented yet. So they called them aqua lungs. You know? And every time I heard
my mind goes to Jethro Tull.
Mine does too. I immediately hear Steve Roe and Jethro Tull every time.
how funny.
Well, what about scenes? Were there scenes that you remember in this rewatch or that got to you or whatever?
Well, the scenes that stick out to me the most are the ones that are repetitive because they want you to remember them. And it's usually involving his hand coming out of the water.
Right.
Either on the shore or on the boat.
Yep.
However, they did point out in the documentary I watched that those nails were rubber, and when it drags itself back into the water in the very first time you see it, you can see the pinky nail or the thumbnail bend.
Yeah, my worst one was when he first, right before they capture him and he picks her up, because she does that awfully convenient film trip where she falls just perfectly for him to reach his arm underneath her knees and her back and pick her up, you know? But when he turns, when the creature turns, his fingers actually bend. The claws actually bend because he's holding on to her and her skin's pushing. And, you know, I was thinking, okay, there's no way this creature could ever hug anybody. Those things would rip to shreds people. But yeah, his rubber fingernails bend, and I went, oh man, that sucks.
Yeah,
but
and I don't know if you know, we were talking about the makeup earlier. There was another design for him before they came up with this one, and it didn't look that good. It looked more human. And they were going to use it as a female version of him in a future film, but they never did. Mm. And they showed one of the people in this documentary had it. They were like holding it up and waving it in front of the camera.
Huh. No, yeah. I was not aware of that. I love the design. I love the gills. I like when he when he walks, you can actually see him breathe. You can see the gills go in and out. The eyes, the way they do the eyes are great. Mm-hmm. You know, when I saw it again, talking about scenes, one of the scenes that got me was the scene where the dude with the pipe, who also is in Tarantula, by the way, the actor.
Is that Dr. Edwin, the one that falls asleep while he's guarding?
Yes. That whole scene, and it just keeps cutting to that shot, looking through the bamboo, and you just see the creature in the water looking up.
You know? It's great.
And I just, and then slowly you see the hands come up and grab the bamboo, and he like tests it a few times. And I was like, going, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. That scene sticks out to me too, because it's the scene where she sets it on fire, which is pretty exciting.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, the underwater scene, like the one that's behind me now, where he's got her in the cave. That's probably a publicity shot, but
that is,
it's similar
because she's dressed different. She has the other top on. That's her bathing suit.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Do you remember what about the opening? What about Evolution 101 there, where they do that whole big bang and all of that? Did you remember that?
I did not, and I thought it was kind of funny how they actually put the Bible in there with the evolution so that they didn't piss anybody off.
Right, right. And they,
God created the world, but then we evolved, or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
And I thought it was interesting. I mean, they spent, you know, it falls into my category. Is this a science fiction movie or a monster movie? Well, it's a science fiction movie, really, because they spend the first 10, 15 minutes making sure you understand evolution and how we came from the water and everything.
Yeah. Well, and some of these I have a hard time classifying. I'm like, so they end up on your list or on my list, and they could be in either, really.
Right, right.
And this one just happened to end up on my list. probably because of the universal connection. Are there any other scenes that stuck out to you?
I always, as a kid, remember they're having their little macho fight over the girl, and in the porthole, you see his hand come in. Another one of your, oh, you just see his hand things. Mm-hmm. But, and the guy in the bandages is laying there, and he can't say anything. He's like, and this claw is like right above his chest.
Yeah.
I always remember that. I thought that was a good scene.
Yeah. I liked the boat. The Rita is a, and it's crusty old, skipper. His name was Captain Lucas.
Yeah, Captain Lucas is great.
It's very, I don't know, African Queen.
That's exactly what I have in my notes. Every time I see a boat like this on the Amazon, it's the African Queen, even though that was right. The Nile, I think. I think they were in Egypt.
You know, I can't remember. My mother loved that movie, and I never watched it.
Yeah, different largest through, river but, in the world sort of thing, but yeah.
You old poop.
Yeah, I've got the boat reminds me of the African Queen, although a different continent. So, yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm. There you go. I do have – I don't have a lot on casting because I don't know a lot of these folks. I really liked the guy that played Dr. Reed, Richard Carlson, but everything I read about him, they said he was an asshole.
He was Mark. Was that Mark, the doctor?
No, David. No, Mark played an asshole. David was the hero that was actually an asshole.
Really? The actor? Okay, because I really liked him, too. I thought he was really good.
I do. I think he's great. Another thing I was going to mention is that I think it's kind of refreshing that we have a movie where men are running around scantily clad almost the entire film, because they are.
I was going to ask you about that. I was going there's a lot of... shorts in this movie.
It's the opposite. Usually it's women that are naked halfway or most of the film. Mm-hmm. And in this one, the men are running around in bathing suits the entire time.
Yeah.
I've got that a guy named Frank Lovejoy was considered to play that role. I don't know who Frank Lovejoy is, so that really doesn't say a lot. But this is the 1950s. And then the only other really note I have on cast we've briefly covered, and that's Rico Browning. He was a professional diver and swimmer and required to hold his breath for up to 4 minutes at a time as the gill man. The director's logic was that air would travel through the monster's gills, and thus air bubbles from his mouth or nose must not be seen.
Makes sense.
Thus, the costume was designed without an air tank. But in the subsequent films, this was ignored, and they added one. And that's why you can see bubbles more in the second two films than you can
well,
in
now,
this one.
Richard Carlson was also, you know, going back to him for a second, he was also in It Came from Outer Space.
Oh, yeah. I did read that some of these guys were in some of the other movies.
Yeah, it's a very, we're all in this together sort of casting thing. And okay, let me ask you while we're on casting. Mm-hmm. Mark, the guy that played Mark, I can't remember his name.
Richard Denning.
First of all, he reminded me sort of, I even have on my notes, he could be the brother of that doctor from the Deadly Mantis, you know, because they look a lot alike. But were there times when he talked and you thought he was Casey Kasem? I swear to God, he sounded, their entire paragraphs that he's saying, where I was saying, oh my God, that sounds exactly like Casey Kasem.
No, but I kept thinking that Richard Carlson was the guy that was Donna Reed's husband on the Donna Reed show.
Oh, okay, I can see that too.
But he's not. No. I mean, I think what it is it's that 50s black and white thing where it's not, and also the science fiction element as well. All those movies start to kind of run together sometimes as far as there's always a professor running around.
Yes.
There's always a scientist of some kind. And, add the black and white and the era, I think it's easy to confuse it, especially for someone of another generation like us.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cast was really strong in this. I even like the little, mm-hmm. I love the, you know, Professor Lucas. Captain Lucas, I thought he was really good. And I like the original professor at the beginning, trying to, you know, explain his case and do everything.
Dr. Carl, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really a, and even the girl, although, they tread a really fine line between making her the object of the creature's desire, but also keeping her kind of relevant, because she is a scientist. She's not just a girlfriend, but they also kind of relegate her to the girlfriend a lot more than they should. You know, okay, why don't you stay back here? We'll go look at the tent.
Cause... Go have a swim.
Yeah. Well, actually, they didn't like her to have a swim. They told her they didn't want her to.
It brings me back to what we were saying in guessing why this was the last Universal movie. I mean, this movie has a lot of quality to it. The acting is good. Mm-hmm. The script is decent. The makeup is fantastic. The location's great. I think that after this film and the popularity of sci-fi, things started getting cheap.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this is one of the last ones that still has that classic, well-made feel to it. Does that make sense?
I totally agree. I totally think that's totally true. I mean, I do like Tarantula, which is after this. I personally like Deadly Mantis, although you don't.
We both sort of hated on it, if I remember right.
Yeah, I kind of, watching it again, I was going, not really a good movie.
No. It's cool.
But to your point, I think it took them way until late 60s, early 70s to get back into monsters again.
And I think Hammer took the mantle then. They were like, let's go back to what made it work and just add nudity and blood.
Add boobs and blood, and we got it. Yeah.
Add boobs and blood. Yep. There you go. Perfect.
I have some interesting things about plotting I wanted to ask you about this. I found this online in research, and I thought, I had never thought of that. But there's a theory in a lot of the fandom thing, in some of the fandom, not a lot, that this is actually has some severe racist undertones to it. And
I think I read that.
I was thinking.
Or either that or it was another film I watched
thinking,
recently.
What? I don't. But then when they spelled it out, so they said, here, let me read it. They said, the creature itself is a racist caricature. It's dark skinned. It has large lips. It's very slow and shambling. The dark skinned Amazon creature in the film is only there to be killed. There is a white female heroine who really does nothing but scream and be the object of the creature's desire.
Every horror movie for decades.
But it's up to the white male scientists who actually act very aggressively towards each other and toward the creature because he made eyes at their white woman.
Okay, someone put some thought into that. I don't get that at all, but I could see some brainiac trying to layer that on.
Okay.
As
long as you feel the same, because I was reading that going, I've seen this movie probably two dozen times, and I've never gotten any, I've gotten sexist, but all the movies of that era were. But
I just remembered the movie that I heard the same thing about, and it makes more sense to me this route, and it was Swiss Family Robinson. They said that it was extremely racist because of the pirates, and what it was they were like Asian or Indonesian, but they were all played by mostly white men, and that's where I think they got the racism thing. And when you went there with this, all I could think of was like, aren't those colleagues in the beginning natives, maybe they were played by white men?
No, it was saying the creature was the black man.
I'm just trying to say the only kind of racist thing I get from this is that everybody in the cast is white, which was a victim of the time, not of the film itself.
Yeah.
That whole metaphor of the creature being, from South America and dark skin. I think that's crazy.
Yeah, I agree.
That's something somebody's got too much time to try to layer that kind of metaphor onto. I don't buy it.
Yeah.
Now, someone out there is hating on me right now for saying that, but I'm sorry. That's the way I feel.
Well, and the only other thing, and really my watch notes that I've got, is I really liked two things cinematically about it. I love that one shot where the boat is passing and David is at the front of the boat, almost like Quint in Jaws. But the camera's right. Stationary. The boat's going by, but David is walking backward toward the stern. And he's staying kind of in the center of the frame and the boat's moving. And it's just perfectly timed. It's so cool the way the boat just kind of moves and he's right there.
Yeah.
And then the other one I had that I thought was really cinematic and cool or a great decision was when the creature does attack Mark, he attacks very fish-like. He like first drags him to the bottom like alligators mm-hmm. do, and he does mm-hmm. the death roll with him. He's just trying to roll mm-hmm. and keep him underwater until he drowns rather than, mm-hmm. you know, he literally could rip him into little shreds with those claws.
Right.
But I thought it was really clever that he doesn't fight like a person. He fights like a crocodile.
He was very stealthy, too. I mean, even on land, he was trying to sneak up. Mm-hmm. But underwater, he was trying to sneak up as well.
Did you ever call him the Gill Man, or did you call him the creature? I always called him the creature.
I always called him the creature, but I was aware of the Gill Man moniker.
Yeah. Well, I remember on the model kit, I think it says the Gill Man.
Oh, it may. Yeah. It may. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, I...
And I did have the glow in the
Yeah, back. I don't... I always said the whole title, too. I never said the creature. I'd always go, the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Right.
It's like I had to say the whole thing.
Have you seen Creature from the Black Lagoon?
Just like Phantom of the Opera. I never said the Phantom. I always said the Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, yeah. That's a good key. That's a good one to gather. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's Universal, too, isn't it? I think it is.
Yeah, we should consider that one, too.
I mean, it was... the reason we confuse them is because of the Aurora models. Because the Aurora models had all of these, including Godzilla and the Phantom of the Opera.
Yep.
So they may not have been Universal. I cannot remember. I would have to check on that.
I also have, just like in most of this era's movies, the woman, for some reason, has to change clothes 9 times during the movie. She has more luggage probably on that boat than the men stay in shorts for a good half of the movie, and she keeps changing tops and shorts over and over.
Right. I mean, there was no room for the men to have clothes. Yeah. They were all there. They were hers.
They were all hers.
I mean, that boat was tiny. And yet there was somebody we didn't know sleeping in a bed when the Anne came in.
No, that was the doctor.
That was,
Yeah. Okay. It was the professor that was hurt when he got scratched, the pipe smoker. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You're right. It was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched about 20 or 30 minutes of the sequel, and they immediately tried to get him to Marine Land in Florida or whatever, and I was like, oh, this is terrible. This is like Jaws 3D.
Yeah, that's what...
I'm bring him to a theme park.
I think the only thing from the second one I remember is he's like chained to the bottom of a pool, and it's just stupid. It was...
And a lot of teenagers, because it's the 50s, and they were like cashing in on the whole teen craze, too. So, yeah, I ended up just turning it off. I did watch the documentary, and I did watch this film with commentary, too. So I watched it twice.
Ah, well, good. I mean, it makes sense, I guess, if you're thinking, if Alan, the producer, is thinking about it as a trilogy, then the second one would be the part in King Kong where they take him to New York, you know? Because
same theme.
That's essentially what this is, you know, and that's what kind of Mark wants to do with him, is bring him back to civilization. It's just that they don't get there in this movie. And then the third one, they didn't know where to go, so they instead say, oh, we need to make him more human to show how different
honestly,
he is.
Honestly, I'm not sure if that has anything to do with script development. If it does, I mean, then it does budget.
Oh, agreed.
Because I think they were like, let's not do as much underwater. Let's make him be able to breathe.
Yeah.
That kind of shit.
We don't have that underwater guy who can hold his breath for 9 minutes. Right. We need to do something different. Right.
Now, I will say, and I I could kick myself for not writing this stuff down, but it must have been when I was listening to the commentary. This movie was made for nothing, and it made a fortune. I mean, this movie did really, really well.
Good.
Compared to what they spent on it. Yeah. I wish I had those numbers, but I don't. Sorry.
Keys? You want to do keys?
We can. I have that, and I have trivia.
What about trivia and awards? Anything? Any awards?
Okay. Oh, as far as awards, there's nothing because
I didn't think so.
Back then they didn't nominate these kind of movies. Now, it has won some posthumous awards with, like, DVD releases, you know, classics.
Oh, okay.
Universal classics, that kind of thing. As far as trivia, I have two. One is that Ingmar Bergman loved this movie. It was one of his favorites, and he watched it every year on his birthday.
Really?
Yes. So we have Mr. Auteur, you know, cinema auteur of The Seventh Seal, is a big 50s sci-fi fan. I find that fascinating.
Did not know that.
And then in my territory, Forrest J. Ackerman, the horror writer and science fiction writer.
Famous Monsters of Filmland.
Famous Monsters of Filmland, who owns, he's dead now, but he owns and has a museum in Hollywood of just a shit ton of classic horror and science fiction stuff. I met him once completely by accident, and it floored me.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I will read this because it's a little long. He bought the mask and the claws for the creature costume from a young man who had once used them as a Halloween costume. The costume pieces were discarded by Universal after production of the three films and were later recovered from the studio's dumpster by a janitor who thought the ensemble would make a cool Halloween costume for his son. Other costume pieces were recently sold at auction by Bud Westmore, who was also the, they say who was an assistant to Millicent Patrick, the original designer of the costume. You could tell whoever wrote this was pissed off.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, they found you see the claws a lot, but so they're very detailed, and the mask, and that's what they found in the dumpster were the claws and the mask.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Crazy. So Forry found him.
Good. I mean, yeah. He has so much memorabilia anyway. That's pretty astounding.
I've told that story about meeting him on here, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was sitting next to him, and I didn't realize it was him. We were listening to, I think, Richard Matheson or somebody giving a speech at at a convention. And he looked kind of like Salvador Dali. He was old and had like a mustache. I don't know. He was kind of weird. And he had a cane. And it was like probably Dracula's cane, Bela Lugosi. But I saw this ring on his finger, and it was so cool. And I went, that is a really cool ring. And he said, thank you. Boris Karloff gave it to me. It's from The Mummy. I went, fuck. Then I realized, oh, I know who you are. So, and I was sitting next to him.
So yeah. After you passed out, you said, hey. Yeah.
I was like all excited to watch Richard Matheson, and I'm sitting next to Forry Ackerman.
That's
like,
great. That's excellent.
Yeah. All right. I guess if you don't have any trivia, we can move on to keys.
I do not.
Okay.
So, yeah, keys. I've got two to go first. One, of course, I said King Kong. King Kong all right. The way through this. I think it's a huge plot. It works so well. And then the other one I've got is you reminded me of when you said it about something else, which is Phantom of the Opera.
Mm-hmm.
This has a real Phantom of the Opera ending feel to it. Of he takes her away to his lair. The bad guys, or the quote, good guys come to rescue her. And then he's kind of left to go back, you know, and they take her away and he falls into the, you know, the depths of the sea kind of thing. So I thought that was a good key for this.
It is a great key. I mean, it's the classic Universal key.
Yeah.
A lot of those monsters did that. Frankenstein took the woman back, you know, or whatever, that kind of thing.
Right.
The Wolfman did too. What I was going to say, I think you said the biggest key is King Kong. I say the biggest key is Jaws. And the reason I say that is, well, it is clear that Spielberg was influenced from those scenes of her swimming, where you can see her swimming across the top of the screen.
Oh, yeah.
And you know you're the POV beneath her. I mean, that is so Jaws. You know, the fear of what is underneath you in the water. And then I copied and pasted this thing that Jack Arnold said, and he said his main goal of making this film was to create a sense of dread. It plays upon the basic fear that people do not know what is lurking below the surface of any body of water.
Yes.
And you know you are swimming and something brushes your leg, it scares the hell out of you.
What is it?
And he said, I wanted to exploit that as much as I possibly could. And that's exactly what Spielberg does in Jaws.
Well, and I've got another Jaws for you. It's not just her in the water, which is very inspired by that opening scene with Chrissy in Jaws, but the scene where they're trying to snag the rope and it's breaking the boom off because the creature's in the net, you know, ripping the net open. I was going, oh, my God, that's just like Jaws, where, you know, that's how they lose Hooper, but it breaks the whole mast off, you know, and I was going, okay, that's Jaws. So,
Spielberg, I would love to talk to Spielberg about this movie and see what he has to say. even the boat.
I've got a key again. There's a feel to like a 20,000 Leagues or Nemo or that sort of thing. If this creature could talk, I could see him being Nemo and saying, "You don't understand what it's like in the water. You guys on land suck, and you're invading my world now," kind of thing. So I got that. But I also have I like the fact that they some surmise that he's the missing link or whatever else, but it's kind of falls into all of those movies like Night of the Living Dead and everything else that don't have an explanation. They don't explain the creature or say why the events happened. It just happened. We don't know what created the zombies. Could have been a comet, could have been whatever. We don't know, but we don't really answer the reason. Nor does it become essential that we know that to still tell a good story. Does that make sense?
Right.
You know?
No. I agree. I think there's a little bit they try to, and I think that's where some of these films get so bogged down, like The Deadly Mantis, when they do try to explain it, because they try to apply science to an illogical scenario, and then it just gets convoluted, confusing, and a little boring. They don't do that. There's the drama and the emotion that carries this movie.
Correct. They try at the beginning. They justify all that crap at the beginning about evolution and yada yada and everything else. But it's basically just an excuse to get us to the Amazon, you know.
Yeah, where all the action takes place. I have a few, I don't know what you would call these, coincidental keys, I guess. One is that in the 7-year itch, the Marilyn Monroe movie where her skirt blows up, that's so iconic, the marquee behind her is the creature from the Black Lagoon. That's the movie that's playing.
Perfect. Perfect. That's a great one.
Yeah, love that. I lifted that one. I did not remember that. It's when she's in Times Square. And then another incidental one I had is that since Jack Arnold directed most of the Brady Bunch episodes, there is one where the boys are raiding the girls' slumber party and Bobby is wearing a Creature from the Black Lagoon mask.
Okay. I don't even remember that one, but I'm sure it was good. I don't remember that at all.
Well, as good as the Brady Bunch could be.
I've got, we talked about Gilligan's Island and the fact that this was shot at the same lake at Universal City that Gilligan's Island was. I've also got a key. The beginning of this reminded me of the beginning of The Exorcist. Not the Big Bang stuff, but once the first shot, because it's the guys running to get the professor to come and look at what we found. And that's that first shot in The Exorcist, too, that first sequence when they're at the archaeological dig and they call him over to see the little statue of Pazuzu.
No, I get that. It's like it's an archaeological thing. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I started to think, oh, are there other archaeological? No, not Indiana Jones. No, no. You know, but that one really stuck me. And then the other one I had was this is, and I found this actually on two different documentary things I read about the movie was people said this was a lot like Shadow over Innsmouth, the H.P. Lovecraft novel. And that's true.
Okay, actually. I can see that.
Except it's an entire civilization of these creatures, but it's very, they live primordially, they're from primordial, the old ones, they're underwater, you know, that sort of thing. So I could
see
that.
They're fish people.
Yeah, fish people. Yeah. Yeah.
They are.
And they're they demand people. A sacrifice. You know, you have to have the woman.
And then like one of the old mammoth ones is like this octopus-headed creature.
Yes.
You know, his beard is like tentacles, which is very...
Cthulhu.
Pirates of the Caribbean, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. I wouldn't go that far, but I would definitely put The Shadow Over Innsmouth as a key.
Yeah.
Because clearly it's a fishman.
And, of course, we can't do our keys without saying probably the biggest one that people listening nowadays will understand is Shape of Water. Because Shape of Water obviously is Guillermo del Toro's ode to the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I started to set it up and say that this is an unofficial double feature because I knew we would end up talking about the Shape of Water,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, clearly it is a love letter to this film.
Oh gosh, yes.
So any of you that have seen either or both or haven't, I would definitely recommend watching them together.
Yes. Because you can see the eras, too, that they're made. Mm-hmm. The jerks in this are that, you know, toxic masculinity, we're better, the white scientists coming in saying we're going to make money off of this discovery kind of thing, as opposed to in Shape of Water, when it's still that he still wants to make money off of this thing, but he's an actual evil person. Just that villain in Shape of Water,
He thinks he's superior to everybody.
Yes.
And he can control people by being, you know, a bully.
Yes,
basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the love story is so wonderful in Shape of Water, and it's so well done. But the design, you could tell the design is a love letter to this design as well.
Right, and it won Academy Award for Best Picture, and rightly so. I mean, back then, a film like this would not have won, wouldn't even be nominated.
No.
But this, you know, the Shape of Water dealt with a lot with communication, too, because the creature couldn't communicate with language, and the woman that he falls in love with is a mute, and she can't speak. So you have them communicating with each other with no words.
Yes, it's brilliant.
It's just awesome.
Yeah.
And the design and the makeup is just phenomenal, too.
Well, you're right. We should say that a weird, twisted anti-key to this would probably be Splash, because...
Yeah,
you flip it and it's a mermaid instead of a gill man. You know, we take them out of their environment and they suffer and they have to escape and get back.
I'm putting it in there.
And a sympathetic character helps them. You know, so there you go. Although in Splash he actually becomes a merman, doesn't he? Isn't he at the end of that?
Something like that. It's been a long time. All I remember is that when Daryl Hannah speaks, it's like this loud shrieking noise.
Yeah, she does like that. Nah, 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 nah. Yeah. It's almost like Galaxy Quest.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have any other keys. We mentioned African Queen, of course,
yes,
and Beauty and the Beast, but those also fall. Oh, and I would just say Universal Monsters in general because of that overall theme of... you know, Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, and they haven't, turned their back on the creature, the Gill Man, so to speak. You know, Universal doesn't play up them, or it came from outer space, or monolith monsters, or tarantula, or any of that so much as they do those, you know, five or six icons, and the creature's always up there as one of their icons. Mm-hmm. So that's really good.
Creature. See that picture of the poster?
Yes.
Where its lips are really red.
Yeah.
The lady that played Kay, Julie Adams, said that she said it was really weird. She said you would see all these pictures where he had bright red lips, and she said it didn't look like that at all. She said the suit was really dark. It was like a dark olive color.
Mm-hmm.
Just what you would imagine, she said, but no red lips.
Yep.
All right. Well, I guess that's going to do it for our dive into Universal Movie Monster history this week. Do stay tuned. I will say we have more of this coming up
mm-hmm.
in the future, not next week, but soon. And we'd like to thank you all if you did join us today or if you are considering joining us again. We hope that you're watching us on YouTube, and if you're not, that you're listening to us on one of your favorite podcast platforms of choice.
Mm-hmm.
You can also find us on Patreon if you think that what we say is interesting and that we're not just two nerdy geeks rambling on about nothing. And and on there, you will also see some bonus content plus some subscription content if you're into the original Star Trek or X-Files. And until then, I would like to thank David for being here with me. He is my partner, friend, and co-host.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy this every week when we do it.
I do too.
Thank you, David.
Thank you. And
we will see you next week.
See you next week.
All righty. Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to Johnny Has the Keys. You can learn more about us at our website, johnnyhasthekeys.com, and our Facebook page. Avoid missing shows by subscribing on iTunes and Google Play, and please, please like, rate, and review us. We're doing this for genre geeks like ourselves, and we can't continue without your support. See you next show, and don't lose your keys.